Thank you very much. As you heard, I was asked to share some vignettes about my time working as one of Ellie's apprentices, both during my time at the Lauterpacht Center, which was then just the center, and afterwards, but I'm not going to do that. Instead, in honor of Ellie and his memory, I'm going to tell you a story. And I'm going to tell you only one story, but it is, and every word of it is entirely true. It is the story of my first meeting with Ellie after he had hired me to come and work at the center and with him as his apprentice. I had read the LLM at Cambridge a year or two before that, and during my LLM year, I attended most of the center's Friday lunchtime lecture series, and not just for the free lunches. At the end of my LLM year, Ellie advertised for an assistant, for an apprentice, for another one of the apprentices you've heard about over the course of today that he had serially in his practice. And it was my luck that one opportunity arose just as I was finishing my LLM. Of course, at its height, Ellie had the largest and most varied public international law practice in the world, and a series of apprentices worked with him throughout his practice. I applied, I was interviewed by Ellie, and I was selected out of hundreds, literally hundreds. And with no false modesty, professionally, this was the equivalent of someone like Steven Spielberg picking out a chorus line dancer and making him the lead of his next Star Wars movie. With no exaggeration, it, as someone else, I think Penny said, it made my career. Years later, I asked Ellie what had made him pick me. He told me that he had picked me because in the year before I came to do my LLM here at Cambridge, I had worked in Bogota, Colombia, at an international human rights NGO for $10 a week, and I'd been shot at for my efforts. And Ellie said he hired me because he felt that I had a moral claim to the opportunity, because I had shown a genuine commitment to public international law. Now, Ellie was far too kind and British to say that I would not have had a chance with him otherwise. But this reflects the sort of public international lawyer Ellie was, and what values he held dear and tried to promote in his professional life and his life in the academy, and nowhere more than in the center. Ellie was a custodian of public international law, and the center is the temple that he built. One of the things that Ellie has always took care to do, was look backward from his position of eminence in the field. He noticed, and he helped, and he mentored, and he encouraged those coming on. And those he helped remembered him and remember him as a kind, compassionate, and caring supporter. And many of those people are here today. When I was in New Zealand earlier this year, I had occasion to meet with Sir Kenneth Keith and Sir John McGrath. Both of them were involved for New Zealand in the nuclear test case in its 1995 reprise at the ICJ, and you've heard other people talk about this case. When I met with them, they spoke to me with a great fondness for Ellie. Ellie had been involved, as you know, in that case. You've heard the history about it. And it occurred to him when he saw what was happening with the French underground testing in the 1990s, it occurred to him, he told me, sitting watching the television, that something really ought to be done in terms of public international law and making a state comply with its obligations. So he came up with the idea that the court had decided to maintain a watching jurisdiction over the issue. As an afterthought, he asked me to do a memorandum as a reality check, and then, I'm sure disregarding anything I had to say, he contacted the New Zealand Solicitor General, John McGrath, and New Zealand's public international law luminary, Kenneth Keith, and he convinced them that it was worth bringing a reprised case to the court. Quickly, New Zealand did so, and that reprise had a significant influence on the outcome of the nuclear test advisory opinion issued by the court shortly thereafter. And I can tell you that Ellie is still warmly and vividly remembered in New Zealand for his role. But that was a few years after I first started my work at the center. And I can remember the day I arrived, I was shown to my office and also to my living quarters. I not only worked at the center, but I also lived there for a time, as did other junior public international law scholars paying subsidized rent. And that was yet one of the many ways, quietly, that Ellie helped young and struggling public international wannabes with all modesty to his own contributions. I lived in a rather chilly room up on the top floor, and there was no sleeping late in those days. Glenn Howard was the center's administrator at that time, and she ran a tight ship. The hot water for the showers was frugally turned off early in the morning when she arrived, so if you weren't up, it was perhaps like Sorelli's cold water baths at Harrow. Ellie was, in fact, on a trip overseas when I started working there in the center. He traveled a great deal for his work, as do most public international law practitioners. Later in my time working for him, and then after, when we kept working together on different cases even after I'd left the center, I had the pleasure of traveling with Ellie. It was always fun to travel with him. Of course, work was work. But Ellie was great company, and he enjoyed life to the full. He was a superb raconteur and a hilarious joke teller. He had a mischievous sense of humor, and he knew the best, the silliest, the bluest jokes. Amongst the most fun were our trips to Bahrain during the Qatar Bahrain case at the ICJ. The Bahrainis were wonderful clients, and they were very hospitable. The feasts that they put on as part of our working sessions when we were down in Manama were delicious. Early on in my time working with Ellie, Kathy made me promise to steer any sweets away from Ellie, and vice versa, to steer Ellie away from any sweets. As anyone who has been charged with this task by Kathy knows, this would inevitably lead to a complex and intricate ballet. The person who was trying to block Ellie from eating sweets would be pushing dishes of cookies away from him and throwing their bodies between plates of sweets and Ellie. Ellie, meanwhile, while speaking with great erudition to a learned gathering or to clients, would maneuver with remarkable agility around people and objects with the relentless objective of sneaking a cookie unnoticed. So when the heaping mounds of mouth-watering Middle Eastern desserts appeared in Bahrain, it was dance time on. As I said, Ellie was away for the first weeks after I arrived at the center to work with him. But we had spoken a few times on the phone in the lead-up, and he'd instructed me. I knew my first job, and I knew what it was going to be. I was to collect and collate the judgments and awards of every single territorial sovereignty case ever published, put them into a series of tab folders, prepare a comprehensive index of cases, and draft a memorandum on certain legal issues. Ellie had asked me to prepare this material to help him in his role as lead counsel and lead advocate for Chile in the upcoming hearing in the Laguna del Desierto case. That was an ad hoc arbitration over the last undelimited land boundary between Chile and Argentina. In fact, the Laguna del Desierto arbitration was one of many cases that Ellie had in the Americas. Another one, perhaps the last one he was involved with in the Americas, was also one of the most congenial ones on which he worked, he told me. That was the case of Barbados and Trinidad. That was an UNCLOS Annex 7 arbitration. The Bajans were fantastic clients, and the case was very interesting for many reasons. Amongst other things, it was the first ever UNCLOS Annex 7 arbitration dealing with maritime delimitation. At that time, there were really no precedents for the procedures of such an Annex 7 case, and so the two sets of counsel had to create procedures from scratch. Ellie's vast practical experience in aspects of the administration of international justice, not coincidentally the name of the title of his Hirsch Lauterpacht Memorial series and then monograph, was invaluable to the process. But turning back to the Laguna del Desierto project during my first days here at the center, I worked at it night and day. I knew that I would only have one chance to make a good first impression with Ellie. Ellie Lauterpacht, the Ellie Lauterpacht, the public international law practitioner of his age, and this was my one chance. I wanted my first work product particularly to be absolutely perfect. I checked and double-checked that I had all the relevant cases. I lay awake at night, shaking at the thought of even the possibility of Ellie looking at me disapprovingly. Those of you in the audience who know him, Ellie had a way of looking at you. He would lift his chin, and one eyebrow would be raised. He'd sort of look at you like this, askance. It was terrorizing. I rewrote my memorandum countless times. I went over the index of cases repeatedly. When Ellie returned from his overseas trip, he had only a few days in Cambridge before he needed to leave for Rio de Janeiro, the seat of the arbitration. With trepidation, at the appointed hour on the day of his return, I approached his study in the center. It was to be our first meeting since he had hired me. Now, most of you here will know the director's study. It's a place of quiet, calm, and reflection. Its windows look out onto the gardens of the center. And at the time, it was full of Ellie's books and papers. They overflowed the shelves and were piled on the floor, a testament to his busy life. When I knocked on the door, Ellie called out, "Come in, come in." This was my big moment with the great man. Ellie sat at his desk, surrounded by photographs of his family. I put the binders containing my work down on the desk where he pointed. He smiled and shook my hand. He courteously asked if I had settled in well. And then his face turned serious and he said briskly, "All right, now, to work." Ellie asked me how I'd gotten on with my assignment. I nervously told him that I thought I had everything he wanted. As he began leafing through the binders I had put on his desk, his face slowly concentrated into a frown. I cleared my throat. From time to time, Ellie asked me a question in a more or less distracted growl. He asked me if I had collected all the cases, and I said yes. He asked me if I had prepared the memorandum, and I said yes. In alphabetic order, he asked. Yes, I said. He asked again if I was sure that I had collected all the cases, and I again replied yes. The study was becoming quite hot and stuffy. Without looking up, Ellie leafed slowly through the index of cases. He asked me, "Did you find the St. Croix River case?" I said yes. "What about the Temple of Preah-Vihear case?" I said yes. He asked me, "Did you include the Ran of Kutch case?" I said yes. Finally, he said, "Is the Island of Palmas case in here?" I said yes. Ellie paused. He looked up and fixed me with a stare. And then he said, "What about the Miangas Island case? I don't see it here in the index." My mouth went dry. You could hear my heart thumping on Grange Road. I could not speak. I stuttered that I didn't know what happened. My mind was in a whirl. I had heard of the Miangas Island case. I thought, surely I hadn't left it out. "Well," Ellie said, "have a look." And he handed over the first binder. I took it. I flipped back and forth through the index. No Miangas Island. Ellie was looking at me. His chin began tilting up. The eyebrow was next. I turned the pages of the index backwards and forwards. My mind was racing. All of a sudden, I stopped, and I slowly looked up. I cleared my throat, and I said to Ellie, "The Miangas Island case is an alternative name for the Isle of Palmas case, which is here." Ellie's eyebrow dropped. His head lowered. The frown slowly turned into a smile. He pointed at me and said, "Got you there, didn't I?"